any problems related to the safety of existing devices and installations, there were still extended dangers coming from the traditional energy with its large number of carcinogenic substances released into the atmosphere. And so to speak, I paid more attention to this side of things. Of course, I was very irritated by the situation that developed between the ministry's leadership and the scientific leadership. It was wrong. According to the discussions and documents, I knew that the true situation was as follows. Our institute was not part of the Ministry of Media Machine Building. It stood close to it as a separate independent organization, and it could dictate its own requirements and its own scientific positions. While the ministry, after it had evaluated the scientific proposals, was obliged to execute them technically accurately. This was a partnership. Scientific proposals that were not limited by the influence of those with power and full opportunity to fulfill that proposal. Of course, if that proposal was accepted by the leadership of the ministry and elected from a technical point of view, this form of cooperation was a correct one. But afterwards, it got to a point when the science department became part of the ministry. The ministry staff has grown up and acquired the needed engineering experience. It seemed to them that they already understood everything scientifically. And so, the scientific atmosphere and scientific spirit of the reactor building department gradually began to obey the engineering will of the ministry. I saw this, and it also worried me and complicated my relations with the ministry, especially when I tried to speak out about it and not in a very careful way. And I couldn't win this, because I was a chemist for the reactor people from the ministry, and this allowed them not to listen to me carefully, and also to treat my proposals as if they were some sort of fantasies. As for the RBMK reactor, it was considered a bad reactor in our inner circle. Viktor Alexeyevich Dorenko had criticized it many times. But it was considered bad, not from a safety point of view. It even stood out because of that. It was considered bad because of economical reasons. First, for the greater fuel consumption, for the greater capital expenditure, for the non-industrial basis of its construction. Also, worrying was the fact that it had an isolated Soviet development line. In fact, more and more world experience was accumulated for the water reactor and hull-based devices, information which could be exchanged, operating experience, used technical solutions, and software. And as for the RBMK reactors, all the gathered experience was our own, domestically. And if you were to look over the statistics, then the statistics regarding RBMK operations were much fewer if we were to compare them to the water energetic reactor. All of this was also bothersome. As a chemist, I was worrying about the fact that in these devices there was a potentially huge threat for chemical reactions. There is a lot of graphite, a lot of zirconium, water, and in some abnormal situations, when the temperature at which the vapor zirconium reaction can begin, accompanied by this release of hydrogen, was unacceptable. This was a point of concern. Another thing that confused me when I was looking at this reactor was an unordinary and insufficient system of safety elements that would work in extreme conditions. Because in case of some unconditional behavior should start to develop, because of the positive reactivity this device had, and if that reactivity coefficient would become noticeable and growing, then the operator, and only him, could have lowered the emergency rods. They could be lowered automatically after one of the sensors sent a command, or by hand using a special AZ5 button. There were no mechanical rods or other protection systems that would be independent from the operator and work solely depending on the system current state. this had created an unpleasant situation. But nevertheless, some practice was already accumulating, and specialists showed confidence to overcome these issues. The speed at which the mechanical rods were lowering was insufficient. I have heard experts, in particular Alexander Kramerov, discuss these problems with Anatoly Petrovich Alexandrov. He made a proposal to the reactor designer to change the emergency protection system, to improve it, and although the idea was not rejected, it was developed very slowly. Especially at the time, the relationship between the scientific supervisor and the chief designer was quite complicated and tense. With regard to any new projects or new ideas, the Reactor Development Organization acknowledged the authority of the Institute of Nuclear Energy. They willingly listened for advice, but in relation to the RBMK reactor, they considered themselves authors and owners. They did not break formal order in which the scientific leadership was under the Institute of Nuclear Energy, but in reality, this leadership was purely nominal. It was used only when principal decisions were discussed, like whether or not to make the RBMK 1500 or should a heat exchange intensifier be added to this reactor. When a proposal came to increase the number of RBMK reactors in the nuclear energy sector, then the support of Anatoly Petrovich Alexandrov was required. These questions were discussed with the science leadership. But regarding the questions of particular technical decisions or improvement of this device, the chief designer did not willingly accept the point of view of the Institute and did not consider the Institute to be developed enough as a partner to provide advice on the matter. In this sense, I would like to express my point of view, of which I'm fully convinced of. This point of view, however, is not shared by my colleagues and causes friction between us, and sometimes very dramatic friction. The fact is that, unlike the West, as far as I know, here in the Soviet Union, there is no such thing as science supervisors, at least not in the developed industries. I understand this myself. Scientific management is a problem. For example, a science supervisor for aviation problems does not exist, but I could imagine one. It would be an organization that had mastered the strategy of aviation development. How many small or large aircrafts are needed? What is more important, boarding comfort or the speed of flight between two points? Should hypersonic aircraft development be primary, or would a supersonic flight be enough? What is more important from a safety perspective, comfortable conditions for ground crew or personnel on board? How many various types of planes should be in the aviation? Such scientific guidance of aviation would have seemed acceptable to me, but when it comes to particular aircraft, it must have a single master. He must be a designer, constructor, science supervisor. This would be all in his power and all his responsibility. All in one hand, I see that as an obvious fact. At the time of the birth of nuclear energetics, all was reasonable, because it was a very new science branch, nuclear physics, neutron physics. The meaning of science leadership was boiled down to setting basic principles of device building for the designer. The science supervisor was responsible for those principles to be physically correct and safe, but it was a designer who was implementing those principles, consulting physicists on a daily basis, whether or not some physical laws are broken within this device. At the dawn of creation of the nuclear industry, all this was justified. But when the design organization have grown, when their own physics departments and calculation departments started to appear, then this double ownership of science supervisor and designer, and in reality triple ownership, because there was a head office and also a ministry deputy who had a decisive vote on one or multiple technical decisions. Multiple councils created an overall collective responsibility for the quality of the device. The situation continues even today. In my opinion, this is incorrect. I am still convinced that a science supervisor or a science supervisor department, which does the expertise to evaluate certain projects and selects the best one, and also defines the strategy of development of nuclear energy. These are the true functions of a science supervisor, and not the creation of some particular device with given properties. This confusion generally has led to enormous irresponsibility, which was exposed by the Chernobyl disaster. One way or another, there was a system of multiple owners, where nobody personally is responsible for the quality of the device with all its facilities. And that was very disturbing among professionals from a technical and an engineering point of view. Of course, it was difficult for me to evaluate the advantages or disadvantages of various nuclear devices. However, one thing I was able to achieve myself, and that was to create an expert group which would perform an expert comparison of different types of devices in terms of their economy, universality, and safety. I supported these activities from an organizational perspective, while the actual work was performed in a laboratory that has been created specifically for this purpose and was led by Alexander Kashanov. He, in my point of view, was doing a great job in this organization. That's because his laboratory was sort of a cell that was raising questions and forming them physically, while the answers to these questions were given by specialists, not only from various departments of the institute, but also from different institutes. As a result, the basis was founded that everything could be discussed widely, be criticized, and then developed. But this work was unfortunately halted in the very beginning because of a serious illness which Alexander Kashanov had, and we were unable to find someone to fully replace him. And then later, Chernobyl happened. The 26th of April, 1986, caught the Institute of Nuclear Energy in a rather odd position. The first deputy, approved and fully supported by the director of the institute, was engaged in organizing a system-wide research into the structure of nuclear energetics, the activity of which was of little interest to the ministry and was ongoing solely because of the support from Anatoly Petrovich Alexandrov. Thanks to this work, it became possible to judge the correctness of various technical decisions. At the same time, I was able to create a laboratory for safety measures, which by comparing with other types of energy, assessed the various dangers of nuclear power. Recently, Alexander Petrovich and Vyacheslav Pavlovich Volkov, the director of the Kola and the Zaporozhye nuclear power plants, told me this episode when a group of his friends visited the Kola station and found that there was a complete disorder from his point of view in the organization process. What examples did he mention? Say someone has begun the shift, he would fill all the measurement journals beforehand, all the parameters, all that, before the start of the shift, and then, until the end of his shift, he sat there, observing the ceiling and doing literally nothing. Maybe only the chief reactor control engineer would sometime leave his chair to perform some operations. But apart from that, it was calm and quiet. No close monitoring of the instrument readings, no attention to the condition of the equipment before the planned preventive maintenance. So this is how his comrade, who had arrived to oversee the work at the Chernobyl station, and said that something was wrong there. When Volkov heard about this, he got worried and called the director of the station, Brukhanov, who then said, "Why do you worry? This nuclear reactor is much simpler to manage than a heat station, and we have experienced personnel, and nothing will ever happen." After this talk, Volkov went on full alert. As he told me at a later point, he called Varednikov from the Ministry of Energetics. Then Shasharin got up to Neporozhny, then reported to that comrade Marin from the Party Central Committee. But what he got in return was only this. Mind your own business. Only Neporozhny said, I'll go and see. So he went and looked, and after he returned, he said that everything was fine and that he received wrong information. And this was not long before the Chernobyl disaster. I think that we could include other industries in this discussion as well. I had visited various chemical facilities. One of those terrified me in particular was in the Chemkent region, a phosphor processing plant. This phosphor plant was a scary thing, terrible working conditions. Just to mention the absence of many managers who should have been on the staff, but who simply weren't there. A very dangerous plant, which was somehow let loose without any control. I was petrified when I had to witness such a situation. Therefore, I fully understood the words of our chairman of the Council of Ministers, from a broader view that the problem was not in the specifics of the development of nuclear energy, but rather was in the specifics of the development of the entire national economy, which has led to this. It didn't take long for his words to be confirmed. After a few months, the collision of ship Nakhimov happened. Such a disaster with the same level of carelessness and irresponsibility. Then, the methane explosion on one of Ukraine's coal mines. Then a train collision in Ukraine. All of these events happened within a short period of time, and they all reflected the overall serious lack of control and punishment in all the responsible areas of our activity. And now, when the situation is indeed like in a story told by Lev Tolstoy, there are no guilty people in the world. When one looks at the chain of events, it is impossible to point to a single guilty person that initiated all these unpleasant events that have caused disaster. The operators made mistakes because they had to complete the experiment, which they considered a matter of honor. This is what led them and their actions. The plan for the experiment was drawn up very poorly, not in detail, and not authorized by the specialists who should have done it. In my safe, I have text records of telephone calls, which the operators did the evening before the accident. It really horrors me when I read those transcripts. One operator calls another and asks, Valera, here in the guide, it is written what needs to be done, but then much of it is crossed out, so what should I do? And then the second one answers, you do as it was written in the crossed out places, you understand? This was the level of preparation on documents for such a crucial matter, like handling a nuclear station. When someone crossed out something, the operator could understand that as right or wrong, and could perform arbitrary operations. But I want to say it again, it would be wrong to assign the entire burden of the blame only on the operator's shoulders, because someone has created the plan, someone has approved it, someone has crossed out parts of the text on it, and someone signed and agreed upon it. And the very fact that the station could independently perform some actions that were not authorized by professionals, this is already a defect in the relationship of professionals within the station. The fact that the station was inspected by representatives of the government nuclear energetics provision, but they were unaware of the undergoing experiment and its program, this was no longer just Chernobyl's reality, but the grim reality of the whole system itself. These are the thoughts that come into my head in relation with the Chernobyl accident. But let's get back to the Chernobyl events from which I have deviated from. As far as I can remember, I ended the narration on how I was impressed by the perfect work of our KGB organization, who without any fuss and with very few men performed an enormous task of establishing a communication and keeping order in the disaster zone. Similar words can be said about the Ministry of Internal Affairs of the Soviet Union and Ukraine as well, because the process of evacuation, quick setup of the perimeter, proper regime and establishing order as much as possible. They did that very well, despite some isolated looting incidents or intrusions into the zone with the aim of stealing property. The amount of such incidents was small, and they were quickly suppressed. The Air Force was working well as well, especially the helicopter groups. This was just an example of the highest order in organization. Despite any danger, they were working extremely precisely. All the crews were doing as much as they can to fulfill their tasks, no matter how hard it was. The first days were the hardest. The order has been issued. Prepare the sandbags. For some reason, the local authorities could not immediately organize a sufficient number of people who would prepare the sandbags. After this was done, the role of helicopter pilots included only one operation: to deliver the sandbags and drop them at the designated places.